Thank you. So you can see from title of my talk, it will be about information coordinate factory system. I'm planning to show you some experimental data from my collaborators, mostly from Jill Aran's lab at Caltech, and also we'll try to present some of our attempts to use computer models to kind of address the questions raised by this data. On Tuesday, we had two wonderful talks about order processing in vertebrate olfactory system, specifically in early olfactory system at the level of olfactory receptors and glomeruli level. And today I will be more talking about kind of more downstream processing of olfactory information and kind of our study, our data coming from insects. So this first slide is just basically to illustrate the point that odor processing in insects and vertebrates are quite similar, at least in kind of on the level of basic principles. So odor processing starts when odor molecule binds to the receptor cell, very much the same way as the game was discussed on Tuesday. So it leads to, in most cases, to depolarization of odor-specific subset of receptor neurons, which increase their firing rate and this kind of pattern of activity produced by receptor neurons then projected to the first olfactory relay in insects, which is structure called antennal lobe. So this is number of neurons in locus antennal lobe. There are only about 1,000 of neurons there. And essentially, the structure is similar to mammalian olfactory bulb. At the same time, it's somehow simpler. So in antennal lobes, there are typically two populations of neurons, excitatory projection neurons, which then sends the output to the structure called mushroom body, which is essentially cortex of those animals. And also one of few populations of local neurons, it has been known for a long time that there are inhibitory local neurons in the system. And more recently, a class of excitatory interneurons has been described in, at least in fly antennal lobe. Yes. Well, it's just a cartoon in this case, yeah. But basically, there is a population, yeah, of excitatory cell and inhibitory cell, and they coupled reciprocally, in kind of at least in the first approximation. You can also say that there are much more Kenyan cells. There are about 50,000 Kenyan cells. So again, yeah, and I thought about was different, yeah. So this kind of, well, cartoon representation, and well, both of them cartoons essentially, but. Yes, this is glomeruli. And in fact, the same glomerular structure is also found in insects. So, and lots of thinking about olfactory processing in this system is actually shaped by this observation that projection of olfactory receptor neurons to the antenna lobe form a very well-defined map. And again, exactly the same way as was discussed on Tuesday. So receptor neurons of a particular type project to only one of few glomeruli where they make connections with dendrites of local neurons and projection neurons. I guess on Tuesday we decided that there is no map really in the system, but there is a well-defined structure. And for example, there are nice data of calcium imaging from Jill Axel and Jin Wang, which shows beautifully that different orders induce different patterns of activity in across olfactory glomeruli in fly and other insects. I should say that there are many data which suggest that odor processing within antenna lobe can be more complex than it can be explained by input from sensory neurons. There are just a few things I'd like to mention. First of all, it's important to realize that any given odor will induce responses in many different receptor types. And the given receptor type will respond to many different odors. So essentially, for example, if we'll be talking about a family of similar odors, similar biochemical structure, we could expect that patterns of glomerular activation would be quite similar. Also, both lateral excitatory and inhibitory connections have been described in antenna lobe, and this connection potentially can kind of reorganize and mix information coming through individual factory channels from individual glomeruli. So, for example, activity of a single glomerulus will trigger response not only in projection neurons which directly connected to this glomerulus, but also in a number of other projection neurons because of lateral connections between them. So essentially it can kind of change information on its flow to cortex, to the mushroom body. And also there are oscillations. This is an example of oscillations recorded from this guy's recordings done in this case in the mushroom body in helix, where essentially output from a local field potential recordings recorded in the mushroom body, where output of all projection neurons kind of comes together. So it shows that when the system is stimulated with order, it starts to oscillate. Local field potential shows oscillatory response, and bottom trace shows recordings from one projection neurons in the antenna lobe, which kind of changes spike in activity, which becomes somehow correlated with these oscillations. So when we started this project just about 8 years ago, one of the first questions we wanted to ask is what was the mechanism of these oscillations and what could be the functional role of this oscillatory activity. So again, this is data I just showed you, and this is a model we designed many years ago now, which represents simplified version of insect antenna lobe as a population of interconnected excitatory projection neurons, inhibitory local neurons. It's conductance-based model based on kind of our best knowledge about intrinsic conductances and coupling in the system. So it's not really that much surprising that when the system is stimulated by non-oscillatory input, kind of representing input from olfactory receptors, it does show oscillation. So the stop trace shows the average activity of all projection neurons in this network over time. And so you can see that when this kind of non-oscillatory input is just some random component on top of it arrives to the system, it triggers oscillations. So it's basically the same mechanism which is responsible for oscillations in many brain systems, for example, cortical gamma activity or presumably gamma oscillations in the olfactory bulb. So it's mediated by feedback inhibition from local neurons, and it has been shown experimentally that blocking inhibition in vivo, for example, by ticretaxin, can actually block this oscillatory component. What was... I mean, this system? So in this case, convolve a bunch of Poisson-distributed spike trains from kind of individual receptor neurons together, because like I mentioned, there are about 800 projection neurons in antenna lobe and about 50,000 receptor neurons. So there is very strong convergence. So each given glomerulus receive lots of input, and essentially this input was stimulated by kind of using just averaging across many spike trains. And it's pretty much similar to what really output, at least if recording has been done from antenna directly, and it could show kind of profile similar to what we used. What was more interesting, however, when we look at the responses of more precise responses to individual projection neurons, we found that, again, it was also described experimentally, that not all projection neurons are actually synchronized at each given time moment. So what is shown here, so the top trace shows local field potential, which is kind of basically clock in the system, because it shows 20 Hertz oscillations, and we can look at each, at the phase of spikes produced by individual projection neurons in different cycles, basically different time moments, and also can look across across trials. So this is what's shown here. Each dot here represents one spike. So middle of this gray box corresponds to the peak of LFP, so it's basically zero phase, and the same order has been, the same stimulus has been applied a number of times. So we have about 20 trials here, and because of the noise in the input and kind of different initial conditions, response is not quite identical. So we can see that some neurons at some cycles respond quite reliably across trials, so they kind of fire in synchrony and presumably contribute to this peak of LFP. And there are other situations when spikes are over the, or kind of all over the place across trials. So presumably Giving self doesn't contribute to the LSP, at least at this cycle of activity. So what was suggested that basically these oscillations as we see them are created by order specific population of projection neurons. So what this cartoon shows, the black dots kind of indicate cell which might be firing in synchrony at given time. And as time progresses, a different group of cells become synchronized, creating this what we see as a local key potential activity. However, some other cell can be still active or silent, and even if a cell is active, it might very well spike without without synchrony with the rest of the population. So there is a kind of order specific subset of neurons which are synchronized together, and this kind of pattern evolve over time. So why it would be important? So we can look how the system responds if it's stimulated by very similar inputs. Again, this is a very probably rough kind of model of chemically similar orders, because presumably those orders will induce responses in highly overlapped population of receptor neurons. So this what is shown here is essentially input versus cell index in this model. So each curve represents strength of the input to different cells. This kind of shown also here. And essentially it shows three different kind of orders of three different inputs. And two of them are very very similar to each other, in sense that very similar group of neurons are stimulated. So it's not surprising that with such similar orders, similar inputs will induce responses in very similar population of antennal lobe neurons. However, if you look at the temporal structure, the patterns of synchronization, you will see they are remarkably different. So different cells are synchronized at different time moments in response to each of this kind of inputs. And so the idea is that basically after yeah. So in this case, it's a model. So this is what I'm showing here, the model data. So it's not a measurement. In this case, it's a model. So in experiments, yeah, the one way to do this would be use, for example, binary mixture, when you can change kind of proportion between component and trying to. Of course, the one problem with kind of analyzing the data is that you need access to large population of cells. So in locust, it's more easy to get such a data set, because in locust, only one population of cells is spiking projection neurons. So it's possible to use tetrad recordings, which would let me turn it off. So again, this is a model, and the experimental data shows existence of this patterns of synchronization. So it's kind of basically this modeling study has been inspired by experimental data from locus. So again, to kind of making some intermediate conclusions. So the point is that the idea is that after processing through the antenna lobe, identity of order is represented both by identities of the active PN, so basically which cell has kind of become active in response to this order, and also which cell are synchronized to each other, kind of timing in those cells. And this temporal structure may be unnecessary to discriminate between chemically different orders, so I'm not claiming that it's really kind of absolutely necessary for processing any order, but it might become important, and I hope we'll have time to show you this when we are talking about discrimination between similar orders, which possibly represented by which presumably induce responses in similar population of receptor neurons. So the next question we obviously wanted to ask is why cell becomes synchronized only transiently, and since we knew that kind of what is the mechanism of synchronization in the system, which is inhibitory input from local neurons, we could look more specifically, more precisely at kind of input which individual PNs receive from their presynaptic inhibitory local cells. So what is shown here, let's look at one projection neuron, which is shown in blue color, and Because of random connectivity, it receives input from some subset of local neurons. So it's less than total population of LMs. Depending on how many of these local neurons could be active at different cycles, strength of inhibitory input to a postsynaptic projection neuron will be very different. And indeed, when we look at the correlations between precision of spikes in each projection neuron and total strength of inhibitory input cell receive at different cycles, we found very strong correlation. So essentially, cell which receives strong inhibitory drive at a certain time moment would spike in synchrony with field potential, and presumably would be part of this ensemble of synchronized cells. And some other time, the same cell might receive no inhibitory input at all because its presynaptic local neurons could be silent in this given time, and the cell would spike randomly. And three different examples, given different time moments when it receives input from all presynaptic local neurons are active, only one of them active, and there is no active cell at all. Of course, we just remove a question from why PN synchronized transiently to another question, why activity of local neurons change over time. Well, this is quite interesting theoretical problem. So we one of the projects we are working now, we are trying to apply graph coloring theory to understand why activity of inhibitory population actually breaks into clusters which evolve in time in kind of very specific matter. So I just very briefly. So essentially, the graph coloring is an approach when you can look at the graph and assign different colors to different nodes of the graph using the principle that nodes which are connected to each other should have a different color. So essentially, for example, if you have two reciprocally coupled two nodes, for example, two reciprocally coupled inhibitory cell, obviously we'll have to assign two different colors because they're connected. In this case, we can use three different colors because these pairs are not connected to each other. So why it's important? We are talking about inhibitory network, and obviously cell which coupled to each other with inhibitory connections will tend to inhibit each other, and those which are not directly connected could be active at the same time. So this is a kind of example of activity which is produced by this population of cells. So you can see that it breaks into clusters when only one group of cells is active at each given time. So when this group of cells is active, it suppresses activity in other neurons, which kind of stay silent over the short period of time versus cell index. And why does it switch? It's simply because over time, there is a spike adaptation, and it was shown that spike adaptation is the reason local neurons in this locus and frontal lobe. So spike adaptation in this is a voltage trace of one of these guys. The spike adaptation reduces inhibitory drive, essentially coming from active population to silent cell. And at some point, some other neurons can escape from inhibition and become active and essentially suppress activity in other neurons. So if you block, for example, adaptation, we don't have these switches anymore. So is it true for real system? We are trying to analyze data now. This is it's difficult with recordings from local neurons in the system. So this example of recordings from two LNs in locus and frontal lobe, which kind of showing some pattern in structure, but we don't have enough really data at this point to make a strong statement that indeed different cell kind of switch in frequencies. But again, this is kind of one potential mechanism which can explain why how this inhibitory network. Again, I'm talking here about population of inhibitory cells which reciprocally couple to each other within antenna lobe. How this population of cell can kind of break into dynamically into clusters. And now we can imagine that if we have a projection neurons which receive input from one particular group of cell, or for example, this shown with this orange color, it will be synchronized only at specific times when the cell are active, and at other times when its presynaptic local neurons are silent, this population wouldn't. Um, Well, the point is that because they're not inhibiting to each other, so there are two kind of parts of this question. Why are precisely synchronized spikes precisely synchronized? It's not necessarily true if there is no feedback from excitatory cell. But why all of them active, kind of become active together is because there is a depolarizing input to all of the cells, so they all of them tends to become active. But only cells which are not inhibiting each other can be active at the same time. And those cells, by definition of this kind of coloring, they would suppress activity in other neurons. So presumably when the group of cells is active, it's inhibit to other populations which remain silent and... So, well, it's you can. Well, there are lots of studies which show that if you have a reciprocally coupled inhibitory cell, they will tend to fire kind of in alternative patterns. So, yeah, it depends on the strength of inhibition. Yeah, it was shown in theoretical papers by Barton et al., for example, many years ago, that depending on strength of inhibition, yeah, it can either become synchronized or they can start to oscillate kind of out of phase alternatively, so in antiphase basically. And this is what happens here.
Actually, also, I think there are studies that show when you have both the antiphase and the in phase possibility, there is, it's the antiphase that becomes unstable. So what's the in phase?
It depends on in strength of coupling and also timing of inhibition, essentially. I think slow inhibition.
But it depends on details of the detailed assumptions about the dynamics.
Right. At least, if I remember correctly, the slow inhibition tends to synchronize the cell in phase, and fast inhibition tends to synchronize them more out of phase. This is what I remember from, again, Solbart papers. And yes, it's definitely possible. But again, both possibilities exist, and we propose that this is what happens in this system, is kind of a regime when cell tends to synchronize out of phase, well, antiphase essentially. So when one population is active, it's providing inhibitory drive and suppress activity in other, and then it escapes. And what we propose that I already said that the idea is after processing through the antenna lobe, what identity is represented by identities of XFP and the relative timing of spikes. And but we also propose that inhibitory drive from local neurons provide a potential mechanism for PN synchronization, and transient nature of PN synchronization essentially depends on variations in inhibitory drive from local neurons over the duration of response. So why it could be important? Because obviously it all makes sense only if those downstream neurons kind of have a capability to extract this information. Otherwise, information about time and spikes. Otherwise, it's kind of senseless to propose that this is a component of or the coordinate in the system. So what we did, and I'm kind of moving to the second part of my talk, I would like to talk now about a downstream population of cell, canyon cell of the mushroom body, which receive input from projection neurons. In locust, there are about 50,000 canyon cells, and presumably, at least based on some estimation, each of these canyon cells sample about 50% of PN population of antenna lobe. So there is kind of very strong convergence of input from antenna lobe to mushroom body. This is data from Jill Aran's lab, and which basically shows that responses in the mushroom body are very sparse, actually very much similar to what was described in olfactory cortex. So what is shown here is the response matrix. So it's, I believe, about 20 orders have been tested across 74 canyon cells, and black dot indicate a case when there is a response, and a reliable response across trials. And the white kind of space shows situation when a given canyon cell doesn't respond to a given order. So you can see there are much more kind of white space here, which suggests that, which indicates that canyon cell typically are silent. So a given order will reduce response, presumably only a small fraction of canyon cell, at least what recordings show. And if chemical is active, it typically become active quite reliably across trials. So a given order will reduce response in at least, again, across this population of 74 Kenyan cell using this in data set, because very few of them, and a given Kenyan cell will respond typically only to a few of orders tested. So responses in the mushroom body are very sparse, and again, it's quite similar to what has been shown in olfactory cortex. So the questions which we kind of wanted to ask here is, essentially, what chemical properties are required to record all the information recorded by special temporal patterns of PM spiking, and what properties are necessary for sparseness of order representation in the mushroom body? It turned out that there are at least two mechanisms which can control sparseness, which would allow Kenyan cell to be selectively sensitive to the synchronized inputs. As you can imagine, for Kenyan cell to be capable to extract information about synchrony, they should operate as a Kenyan detector. They should be sensitive to the inputs arriving within a small temporal window. So one group of evidence suggests that there are intrinsic conductances in Kenyan cell, which seems to be kind of facilitating responses to synchronized inputs. So this is the recordings from three different Kenyan cells for inputs at different amplitudes. All these responses are subthreshold, so there is no spikes. What it shows that when input exceeds certain level, it kind of become quite sharp, presumably because as a result of activation of some intrinsic conductances. And this is also what we modeled several years ago when we designed the conductance-based model of the Kenyan cell. Also, there is another mechanism which also potentially contribute to a kind of property of the cell to be sensitive to the synchronized input from antenna lobe. I'm talking about feedforward inhibition from lateral horn. So input from antenna lobe arriving to the mushroom body, the same input actually goes to another structure which is called lateral horn, and it's a small population of inhibitory cell which again, we see the same input from projection neurons of antenna lobe and then send inhibition back to the Kenyan cell. So this is basically a very kind of classical example of feedforward inhibition, also found in cortex and almost every many other systems, except that in this case, population of inhibitory cell kind of separated physically from Kenyan cell. Essentially, what each Kenyan cell sees is excited input from projection neurons of antenna lobe, followed with small delay by inhibitory input from lateral horn interneurons. What we showed, and probably wouldn't have time to talk about this more in detail, so I'll just kind of summarize it here, that this input essentially reset Kenyan cell activity at each cycle of local field of oscillations. So define a window of time when Kenyan cells are capable to integrate input coming from antenna lobe. Also, it was quite interesting that this is kind of circuit provided potential mechanism to control responses across a range of order concentration, because what we again suggested that as order concentration change, it will change the input from antenna lobe, which potentially advance timing of spikes in inhibitory cell and essentially create small integration window for Kenyan cell to spike. So if I, yeah, maybe we'll talk a bit more about this later if I have time. But now I will just want to show you, so what happens if we stimulate, if we simulate such kind of more complete model, including population of antenna lobe neurons and also Kenyan cell and LHIs. So this is again response matrix now generated from the model, which shows the responses of Kenyan cell, a small subset of Kenyan cell, 20 cells are shown here for 10 different orders. And again, black dots indicate order cell pair when there is a response in Kenyan cell. So you can see that it's when this two mechanisms which I described implemented to the circuit, intrinsic kinesial properties which make them sensitive to synchronized inputs and also feed-forward inhibitions and lateral horn. The system indeed is capable to respond very sparsely to stimuli from input from the antenna lobe. I should mention that in this particular experiment, we use a very similar set of orders. Again, I'm going back to this plot I already showed you, and for this experiment, we use orders which highly overlap at the level of the input to antenna lobe. Interestingly, if we pair the same system using different decoding strategy for Kenyon cell, so now Kenyon cell operate as integrators, so they have a large integration window, so they're kind of capable to sum inputs from antenna lobe over larger time interval. It's still possible to achieve sparseness of responses, so a given order still would induce response in only small fraction of Kenyon cell, but the system become incapable to discriminate between those similar orders. So the idea is that if this fine temporal structure of synchronization present in the input from antenna lobe to the Kenyon cell can be read out, but to do it efficiently, those Kenyon cells should be, again, sensitive to synchronized input, should operate as the Kinesis detectors versus beam integrators. So in this model, each Kenyon cell, again, sample about 50% of population, and synaptic weights were the same, yes.
So if you change the synaptic weights in different cells,
and depending on
the amount
of parts of it, we had a separate project, and we tried to explore if synaptic plasticity from antenna lobe to Kenyon cell can actually helps to provide sparseness. And so we essentially implemented STDP model, and we tested this trained this network with different orders, which led to kind of different distribution of synaptic weights. But we didn't test this very specifically, but in examples, in simulations we had, we basically, as soon as Kenyon cell degradation window was large enough, the cell didn't care anymore about specific timing of spike. So at least performance was much worse than versus Kenyon cell, which used pain detection type decoding. My 5 minutes. Okay, so I just mentioned, of course, this kind of high sensitivity could also imply that the cell, that the system might be, might respond unreliably. So what happens if we test it with, again, we use multiple trials of the same order, and because of, I already mentioned, variability in initial conditions and in state of the system, each trial produces slightly different response. So what happens if we test the system with a subset, again, with similar different orders across many trials? So to visualize responses, what we did in this case, we take our population of 15,000 Kenyon cell and essentially represented response of this entire population for a given trial of a given order as a point in this high-dimensional space, and then we just visualize it using principal component analysis. So each point here represents response of Kenyon cell population to one trial with one of those three orders shown here. So you can see, indeed, because of some variations across trials, it produced slightly different responses, but remarkably, those responses are very well grouped. And for example, even for order 2 and 3, which are very highly overlapped at the level of the input to antenna lobe, at the receptor level, essentially, responses in the mushroom body are very well separated. So the idea is that this processing through the antenna lobe kind of helps to increase sensitivity of the system by decorrelating essentially similar inputs. So it's kind of cartoon shows bunch of orders within each group. Orders are highly overlapped at the level of the input to the antenna lobe,
And the representation in the mushroom body shows much less overlap, and at the same time they preserve kind of responses still reliable across tiles. So basically, what I showed you, the screen detection allows to read out the order information coded by synchronization patterns of screen activity, and I also tried to illustrate the point that screen detection offers a number of advantages for encoding sensory information, including greater stability against input noise and greater ability to discriminate between related input vectors. So I can stop here because I have. So I can just move to the last. The last. Okay. Well, it's an advantage to have kind of talk break into pieces. So I have a few more things, particularly about all the concentration, which I, if somebody interested, we could discuss later on. But basically, I just want to summarize. So what we just discussed, that the idea that after processing through the antenna lobe, all the identity is encoded both by identities of the active PNs and the relative timing of spike in those PNs. And the second feature might become important for discrimination between similar input vectors. So the Kenyon cell operating as Kenyon detectors looking for synchrony in the input from PNs, and this is kind of way to decode information. Offer some greater ability to discriminate between similar inputs and greater stability against noise. And something I mentioned very briefly, feed-forward inhibition from lateral horn kind of changed dynamically Kenyon cell integration window, and it allows to preserve sparseness of Kenyon cell responses across a range of order concentrations. So to my group who contributed to this work, and my collaborators, Jill Aran and Mark Stotfeld. Thank you. Well, I don't know honestly about any kind of neurogenesis ongoing in the system, but speaking about less. Yeah, so for example, this recent paper from Gilles Laurent's lab, which shows that. External synapses of Kenyon cell to the alpha beta lobe actually shows spike timing dependent plasticity. I think it was first observation of STDP in at least in insects, at least as far as I know. And I already mentioned that we kind of propose plasticity operating at afferent synapses from antenna lobe to the mushroom body as a way to kind of stabilize the system and to stabilize synaptic weights again to achieve sparseness. Well, this is basically the kind of idea behind, in general sense, why a sparse representation might have its advantages. Because essentially, mushroom body is a place where all the information is categorized and essentially prepared for memory storage. And the idea is that it's very much similar to possibly happens in birdsong. The sparse representation actually brings number of advantages, increased capacity of the system, and also facilitate kind of readout of this information. So rather than checking lots of cell for the activity, it might be easier to read out information from smaller subpopulation. So we didn't. Yeah, this exactly.